The meeting today. Welcome to the House Committee on Judiciary. I'm going to give just a minute, although I may wait until a couple of the more of the members arrive, if that's okay with you, Mr. Taylor. So we'll go ahead and just get into the issue. Could you snag me the witness list for the bills, and we'll start. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2059. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, 2059 was introduced at the request of the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary. At the request of the Oregon State Bar Debtor Creditor Section, it creates a procedure for filing a bond or depositing money when possessory chattel lien is claimed for the storage of chattel. To put that into layman's terms, essentially a debtor who has some type of personal property subject to a claim as collateral, for instance, a motor vehicle, would be able to deposit a loan or a sum of money or take out a bond for, I believe, 150% of the value of the vehicle, and then the debt, if collected or foreclosed upon, would be foreclosed on either the sum of money or the bond, and the vehicle would be free and clear for the debtor to use it for his or her personal business. This would obviously apply to more than just vehicles, but that is the general sense of the bill. I believe we have some witnesses.
We do, and let's start with Gary Blackledge, who's representing the debtor-creditor section of the State Bar. You want to come up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Gary Blackledge. I'm a Portland attorney in private practice. My practice emphasizes collections, creditors' rights, debtor-creditor issues in real estate and commercial transactions, and I'm appearing before you as a representative of the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar. House Bill 2059 is designed to as a mechanism for allowing an owner of a chattel that is subject to a possessory chattel lien to bond off the lien to essentially stop storage charges from accruing if that chattel has been placed in storage, so that the debtor can have the use of the chattel while the dispute is pending, and it sort of will, you know, stop the ongoing accruing storage charges while the dispute is resolved. It's patterned after the construction lien bonding statutes in Chapter 87 to effect the same thing. Now, we think that this may also benefit some of the chattel lien claimants, in that instead of a vehicle with a questionable value after foreclosure, they would actually have a bond or deposit under which they could satisfy their lien if they ultimately prevail. The debtor-creditor section urges the subcommittee to refer House Bill 2059 to the full Judiciary Committee with a due pass recommendation. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Why don't we have you stay up there, Mr. Blackledge, and we have two other witnesses sign up to testify in opposition to the bill, and then we can have a dialogue with all of you to respond to questions.
Sure.
And that's Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Tow Truck Association, and Deb Elkins, representing Northwest Auto Traders, if you'd come forward as well.
Good Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Tow Truck Association. First of all, I'd like to thank Gary for the opportunity for me to talk to him the last few days about this bill. And part of our membership, we have three lien companies that do a fair amount of liens for towing, possessory liens, Auto Lien Service, Oregon Lien Service, and Sargent's Lien Service. And while Mr. Blackledge did an excellent job of explaining the bill and its ramifications to me, I, in turn, did not do a very good job of explaining it to these three lien companies. And we would like to have the opportunity to sit down with the sponsor and talk about the issue and its ramifications to our industry. We do not do a great many liens, from what I am able to ascertain at this point, under this chapter. However, we do some on an annual basis. And the towing industry has little or no experience in the field with bonds. So I think we have a myriad of questions and observations to share with the sponsor, and would like to have the opportunity to do so. And I apologize for not having had this done beforehand. We just haven't had the time to do that. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Al. Deb?
Good afternoon. My name is Deb Elkins, and I'm the director of the Northwest Automotive Trades Association. And I, too, had a conversation with a few of my businesses that I represent, and they do use the mechanics lien process to recover costs associated with the work that they have performed on a vehicle. Their concerns lied in anything that could possibly create more costs to the existing process. They were shaken in their boots, so to speak. It's a costly process when many times they're not able to recover even close to the amount of charges that have accrued against the vehicle. So I, too, would like an opportunity to work with the sponsor on the bill to see if we couldn't come up with a solution to their concerns. I understand the problem that the sponsor is trying to solve. In fact, we've talked about this within our organization. So I think we can come up with a workable solution if given that opportunity. That concludes my testimony, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer those for you.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Representative Anderson.
Maybe you could, Mr. Blackledge, first. Forgot that question. I want to ask all three of a different question. That is, how does this impact the counties and the cities that often take cars under, you know, DUI, those type of violations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I've asked for scenarios from the lien companies on when they've used this chapter in the past, and the scenarios that we've come up with do not involve the Dewey Tows yet. They're still doing research. However, they do involve if we are called to a mechanic shop to tow the vehicle to either another mechanic shop or to our storage lot. They see that may fall under this chapter. However, I've asked them specifically for information on city and county tows in relation to police tows, and if this chapter has been used in relation to that. And there are, and the only way I would see that personally, and they haven't given me the direct answer yet, is if we tow from a city storage lot to another lot, that may happen then. But they haven't given me the evidence to show me that yet.
Okay. Great.
Further questions, Representative Ackerman?
I just want to clarify the additional cost to your industry if this bill passes. And let me see if I can just summarize it. Under current law, you would have the opportunity to foreclose against the chattel and sell it without going through a full-blown court proceeding. Is that correct?
Correct.
Whereas if the bond is substituted for the collateral, that forces you into the full-blown court process. Is that your point?
Exactly. Well said. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, yes.
Sorry.
No.
Representative
Schiller.
Like, yes. I guess just in terms of, do you have a sense in amount? What's a typical amount? Can you identify a typical amount of a lien claim in the situation you're talking about? Let's say in a towing or.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schiller, no, I do not. I've asked for the dollar and cents figures as well from the lien companies, and they we will have that for the meeting with the sponsor of the bill.
I guess one of the, I am interested in seeing how this would get resolved, because certainly in vehicles that have a low value, it doesn't take very long, and maybe some of us at one point or another have experienced the towing and storage charges of a vehicle at some point in our lives. It doesn't take very long for those towing charges to often exceed, or the storage charges to often exceed, the value of the vehicle. And so I sense that what was trying to be accomplished here is, to the extent they could put up 150% of what the possible amount that might be legitimately taken against the vehicle, it would allow them to stop the clock ticking on storage charges that might otherwise, without a very long period of time, exceed the whole value of the vehicle, and then they leave it essentially abandoned. You'd agree that, to the extent we can address perhaps some of the concerns that Representative Ackerman pointed out about the process issues, you'd agree with me that would be an appropriate thing, I think, to allow someone whose car is currently in storage to put up some money, get the car out. Your clients are fully protected in excess of the amount that they might be able to claim under the lien, and they get out from under the sort of ticking clock that daily erodes the economic interest they actually have in the vehicle that's sitting in the impound lot. Would you agree with that?
Representative Williams, Mr. Chair, yes, I do agree with that, and initially that's how I thought the system, I thought this was a good bill for the people I represent. However, when they came back with their concerns, I wasn't able to answer their concerns. But initially, my thinking was exactly the way you just characterized it. They would have that 150%, but I think there's some other implications that I don't know what they are at this time. I'd just like the opportunity to look at that.
Representative Ackerman.
Would a possible compromise be to have the bond in such an amount to cover the value of the chattel, plus your attorney's fees and costs if you were successful in the foreclosure process?
Representative Williams and Representative Ackerman, yes, I would say that would be very workable.
In fact, you could put a cap on those fees in the bonding process if you really needed to.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes,
Chairman Williams, if I could clarify some things, too. Keep in mind that this is only designed for the possessory chattel liens under ORS 87-152 to 162, where the chattel, there's been work done on it, or it's been, put in storage, intentionally, and then there are storage charges accruing because the underlying lien, there's some dispute as to maybe the work that was done on the vehicle wasn't, done properly, and so that possessory lien is in existence on this chattel. Then under 87, I believe it's 175, they're able to get storage charges, while that dispute is pending. So if there is a dispute, many of the situations that the towing companies deal with, I don't think that there's generally a dispute in an underlying lien. If there is a dispute, there may already be, some type of court proceeding, whether it's small claims or who knows, in which case the foreclosure against the bond would be more in the form of a counterclaim, maybe. So if that helps clarify, this doesn't affect the towing liens under Chapter 98 or other, abandoned vehicle type statutes, just the possessory chattel liens.
Further questions? Well, what I'm going to recommend is that Mr. Blackledge, you and whoever else from the debtor creditor section of the bar meet with the Elkins to discuss their concerns and report back through Mr. Joseph as to any accommodations that are made or requests for amendments that might be necessary. Representative Ackerman, is this something that you might be willing to sit in on a discussion of?
I can be available at your request.
So appreciate that. Thank you.
Between the these two, then we can probably get this resolved.
Okay.
Anything further? Any other person in the audience wishing to testify on House Bill 2059? Okay, hearing none, we'll close the work session for the public hearing. We're now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2060. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2060 was introduced at the request of the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary for the Oregon State Bar Debtor-Creditor Section. It directs trustees for closing trust deeds by sale to file an affidavit in the county records describing the amount that must be paid or the performance required to cure the default. As I understand it, and according to the Oregon State Bar, out-of-state trustee service companies are conducting non-judicial foreclosure sales in Oregon, and it is relatively difficult to obtain information on the sales, either for the debtor or other individuals wishing to be involved in the sale, so that they can understand what amounts will satisfy the outstanding debts that the sale doesn't go forward, or how to bid on the item that's going to be foreclosed upon. This bill would require filing in the county, I believe, 7 days beforehand, an affidavit listing the relevant information that somebody wanting information on the sale would need so that they can be somehow involved in the sale.
Okay, and Mr. Blackledge, if you want to come forward again representing the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, I'm Gary Blackledge, Portland attorney, and I'm here representing the Oregon State Bar debtor-creditor section. This problem that we're trying to fix has become quite a pervasive problem. My colleagues are seeing it arising from different circumstances. I was recently contacted by counsel for a local title company in Portland trying to help an attorney from Silverton who had a gentleman who had sold property and carried back a second trust deed. And the buyer defaulted, and the first was in foreclosure, and the gentleman who was holding the second was trying to, before the sale, get information so that he could cure the first and commence a foreclosure of his second so that he could protect his investment in the property. And he could not get the information from the trustee or the beneficiary. It's become quite common that many of the lenders have been swallowed up by other lenders. They're assigning their beneficial interests under their trust deeds. Not only that, they're engaging, you know, servicing companies, usually located in Florida or somewhere, to collect the payments and service the loans. They engage an out-of-state trustee services company when the loan goes into default. And when you try to call these companies to get a cure amount or a payoff, you get their automated phone answering system, and you just about never can get the information that you need in time to do anything. I was also recently representing a bankruptcy trustee, and in that case was an action against a trustee and a beneficiary that the debtor had commenced prior to the bankruptcy filing to try to set aside a foreclosure sale, because this debtor actually had an escrow pending to refinance the property. The escrow could not get the payoff out of the trustee in order to close the deal. They lost it to the foreclosure sale. The only way now to currently stop a nonjudicial trust deed sale is to file an action to enjoin the sale. Well, that probably won't change with this bill. This bill will at least give the borrower, lien creditors, and third-party potential purchasers at the sale the opportunity to see and get an accurate amount of what the debt is or the cure amount is, so that they can tender that sum either at the sale or if they're curing 5 days prior to the sale, which is under existing law. Existing law now provides that the debtor may cure up until 5 days before the sale, but there's nothing in the Oregon Trust Deed Act that says that the trustee has to provide the cure amount. And so I guess that's what we're trying to fix here. And I should advise you all that I've been talking with Mr. Jim Marquis. There are some concerns that they have about the language of the affidavit, in that if we're putting the amount that is to be due at the sale date, you know, what is that amount? And you know, in most cases, I do trust deed foreclosures. I often have to estimate my attorney's fees that I'm going to do in conducting the sale and post-sale, you know, preparing and delivering the trustee's deed and whatnot. And yet, what we might be able to do here is have in the affidavit the amount of the principal, the amount of the interest that has accrued with a per diem, so that it can be readily ascertained, you know, at the sale. And then the affidavit could set forth the actual foreclosure costs occurred through the date of the sale, and then the trustee's best estimate of what those costs will be to conduct the sale. So at least, you know, a party will be in the ballpark with their tender, and, you know, can maybe, you know, tender more than enough to try to keep the from losing the property. And so we are hopeful that we can work something out. If there's any questions, I'd...
Okay, Representative Ackerman.
I think the bill has a great purpose. I detect a few problems, and I'd like to just discuss those, and I may just narrate what those are and see if we have some concurrence on this. The first is rather a simple one, but I don't see that there's any requirement as to when the affidavit must be mailed.
What we have contemplated here is that it must be done 15 days prior to the date last set for the sale. Current law allows the debtor to cure up until 5 days before the sale. We felt if you had to record the affidavit in the real property records and mail first class and certified to the parties that you served the trustee's notice of sale on, that would afford everyone, you know, notice of what the amount to cure and the amount to be bid at the sale would be. And then in the affidavit of mailing that is currently required to be recorded before you conduct the sale, you would include in that you actually, you know, mailed this affidavit and recorded it.
Okay, that I understand that part. Thank you. My second inquiry would be, since the owner and certain subordinate lien holders can redeem 5 days before the sale, we're really only talking about a window of opportunity here, a window of disclosure of about 10 days or more. I was wondering if it wouldn't be more prudent to extend the 15-day requirement to 25 or some period of time. 10 days doesn't seem like very much time if you're a little bit behind in your work. And if I would imagine if the affidavit wasn't filed, then persons would come in and want to postpone the date of sale and start the process all over again. Do you have any comments on that?
Yes, Chairman Williams and Representative Ackerman, we have thought about that, and it was kind of a trade-off as far as, you know, if you're doing it earlier, then there's more that can happen in the sale to, you know, different things that pop up at the last minute. And so we felt that, you know, we had a lot of discussion about this, and that a good compromise was 15 days, because that, you know, allowed at least some time ahead of time. And in many cases, you know, the party that's going to want to do something in these cases are going to be trying to get that information, you know, at least around that time, knowing that the sale is coming down the road. You know, and you know, with I'll say reasonable trustees, local real people that you can get in touch with, when they know that there's an escrow pending or a payoff coming, they'll most of the time agree to postpone the sale, because most of the time the clients would rather have the money than the property. You know, it's we thought that, you know, 15 days was the best compromise under the circumstances. And in part, I should say that the people that have the concern about this, you know, and the amount, stating the amount in the affidavit, that could change, you know, if it had to be given earlier.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering and if we could approach this maybe from a different direction and achieve the same result, because I can see where the issue of what's the cure amount can come up also before 15 days prior to sale. I mean, this may be an issue for somebody desperately wanting to stop the bleeding and get this paid off. What would you think, just structurally, of and then also there's the issue here, and I've done some of these trustee foreclosures, and you always worry about missing one document in the flow of things. If you don't do these and nothing but these, you set out these time charts and you double check your calendar every day to make sure there wasn't something you were supposed to do on that trustee sale, the foreclosure that's 3 months ahead, you know, yeah. Or else you've just blown the whole thing.
It's the guys who do it occasionally.
Yeah, like me.
Like
yeah.
M.A.
But
they feel like they're walking into the minefield.
For the record, they've always worked. But, it is a little bit scary. So I'm wondering, rather than create this one more thing for the creditor to have to do and risk failing to do, and then also, you know, accommodating maybe an earlier request in time, and the need for information and the ability to get current information as to what the cure amount is. What about something in the order of putting the shoe on the other foot and saying if the debtor makes a written request by certified mail, let's say delivered to the we're going to identify who it's going to be, the beneficiary, whoever the case is. You've got those people are identified in the notice of sale. You've got addresses that you can contact there. But they have to respond within 5 days or, you know, you name your time. That way, then, that request can come any time after the commencement of the foreclosure. You get a current amount, and you don't have to estimate then what the fees are going to be on the day of sale. If we're talking about what do I need to cure right now, you can give a current amount both as to the principal, a per diem on the interest, and you know what your fees are to date. And then you're not forcing the creditor to do one more thing, basically, unless they're asked to. And then I guess if they fail to respond, then, you know, the debtor's got an opportunity to bring some issue about stopping the sale because they've been denied their right to cure or something like that.
It does seem that in a great number of these cases, you'd be obligated to send this affidavit out.
Mm-hmm.
Merely as one more thing to tick off, because there isn't anybody that's going to come in and try to, you know, cure the problem. They've headed for the hills or whatever the problem is, and you're going to go through this thing. To the extent that you did give the option and made it mandatory that they had to provide the information when requested, it probably narrows the scope to which they'd have to actually do the work. Did you talk about that at all, Gary, among the group?
Chairman Williams, yes, we did talk about that, and I think that that would work provided that the trustee had to, could not conduct the sale until a period of time after they responded, and that they would have to respond not only to the debtor or a junior lien creditor, but a prospective bidder. I also represent investors who often buy properties at trustee foreclosure sales, and they have the same problem in learning whether the sale is going to be postponed or if the debtor filed bankruptcy and what the minimum bid amount is going to be. And so if the trustee was obligated to respond, you know, and was not able to conduct the sale until they had responded, that would work. And we did discuss that, and the problems that we talked about were sometimes it's not really the trustee's fault so much because the beneficiary may have been sold and trustee assigned, or there's a different servicing company, and the trustee actually can't get the payoff information out of the beneficiary. And so in the discussions in our committee, we decided to go this route, but this isn't by any means the only way that it could be done.
It does raise an interesting point to the issue that you raised, Representative Shetterly, that to the extent that there are potential third-party bidders,
you now put the person who's, you put the trustee, in effect, having to respond potentially to multiple requests for information, with each one failing to respond, potentially hanging something up, as opposed to filing one affidavit, which would be recorded on the record where everybody could go look, discover, and see what it was. I mean, so I recognize the trade-off that obviously was discussed in the section meeting. Do you have a further thought?
We're kind of making this up on the fly. The other option would be that upon request, that you file the affidavit upon request. That way, then, if there's one request, the affidavit is of record. There's obviously interest in the property, and now anybody who's interested can look at the record.
Yeah, that's another way to solve it. That's good. Mr. Marquis, your name was raised, not in vain, I would say, but you're here. Do you want to testify at all at this point? No? Okay. All right. Any other questions, then, for Mr. Blackridge? Well, I think I'm going to do this one, Gary, just like I did the last one.
Okay.
Only this time I'm going to work with Mr. Joseph, obviously Mr. Marquis, and the concerns they've got. And because of sort of my interest in the approach that Representative Shetterly has raised, I'm going to ask him to sort of take point on some discussions between the four of you about how to do that.
Okay.
All right. Is that all right with you, Representative Shetterly?
Sure.
Okay. See, that's what happens when you express an interest on a bill.
It's very quiet committee.
Yeah, that's right.
Mr. Chair, you notice I've not said a word.
This is
not my area. I don't even go for the temporary attempts to fix these things.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2060.
I know you're being pretty quiet. Not my area, I'd say.
Next is House Bill 2061. We'll open a public hearing. And
lots of silence on this one.
Gee, it's Gary Blackledge again. Hi, Gary.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Shetterly.
The hardest problem I had with this bill was finding where the changes were.
The change was. You're looking for that bold print.
Looking for those bracketed asterisks.
Yeah,
I think
right.
Were.
Council, and then we'll go to Mr. Blackledge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 2061 was introduced at the request of the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary for the Oregon State Bar Debtor-Creditor Section. As I understand it, amends Oregon law regarding exemptions to provide that when two or more members of a household are judgment debtors, each judgment debtor may claim only one exemption for a specific type of property. And this has, apparently this is kind of a cleaning house bill in that currently under Oregon law, two judgment debtors, one single, one married, the single judgment debtor in certain circumstances can only make a claim for exemption for $10,000 for certain assets, whereas the married debtor may be able to, under certain circumstances, double that exemption to claim $20,000, and that just doesn't make sense according to the Oregon State Bar and the information that I received. And this would fix some of the earlier changes that inadvertently apparently may have doubled that one exemption.
Okay. Mr. Blackledge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, I'm Gary Blackledge, and I'm here representing the Oregon State FAR Debtor-Creditor Section. There are currently three provisions in 23-160 sub 1 that are lettered J, K, and L. Basically, they are the debtor's right to exempt the debtor's right to receive payment or property traceable to an award for any crime victim reparation law for personal bodily injury up to $10,000 and for compensation for loss of future earnings. The current law allows joint debtors of the same household to double exemptions under J and L, and that doesn't make any sense because the entire amount is exempt. And so if you're exempting the entire amount of an award under a crime victim reparation law or compensation for loss of future earnings, why double it? It just doesn't make sense. The entire amount is exempt. And so we're suggesting that be those two sections, J and L, be deleted from subsection 3 of 23-160. Subsection K is the exemption for personal bodily injury up to $10,000. And if each debtor would have the right to exempt up to $10,000 if that debtor suffered a personal bodily injury. So it doesn't make any sense for the married debtor who was received an injury to be able to double that when his spouse didn't receive the injury. And so the debtor-creditor section believes that that might have been inadvertent because it seems discriminatory for really no good reason. And so we're saying that that subsection shouldn't be doubled, that the debtor who received the injury ought to be able to exempt up to $10,000 for that injury. This bill further makes it clear that the $400 what we call the wild card exemption, which is currently under subsection O, it's been moved about in the past few years, that can be doubled. And so we're adding that to 23-160 sub 3. It's our understanding currently Oregon case law already allows for doubling that $400 exemption. And so this would just make it clear in the statute. So essentially we're saying, we would delete the doubling for J, K, and L and add O. So we recommend that the subcommittee refer this to the full judiciary. If there's any questions.
You are lucky in that this is the full judiciary committee.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, we did do subcommittees this session.
Oh,
so,
okay.
So
well,
one shortened step in the process. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. I do have a question. Again, an area that I don't do much in, but you've got husband and wife, judgment debtors, and an execution is issued against both of them, let's say. Do you issue an execution against two people? Oh, you would, a writ of garnishment, mm-hmm. If there's a contract payment or something like that, let's say, where they're both.
Probably.
Yeah, okay. As I read this, then, if you look on page 4, let's take the asterisk at line 4. Your right to receive property or to receive an award under any crime victim reparation law. Help me out now. Let's say that the husband and wife in this scenario, and this could come up with any of these exemptions, but we're both victims of a crime and both received awards. So husband has an award and wife has an award. Or you could certainly have more likely maybe a personal injury claim where they both received a settlement of a personal injury claim. As I look at the note that begins on line 18, it says, if two or more people in your household owe the claim or judgment, each of them may claim the exemptions marked by an asterisk. As I read this, by taking away the asterisk, we're saying you got to, do you have to pick one of your crime victim awards or one of your personal injury awards, and you can't both claim them?
It's my understanding, Mr. Chair and Representative Shetterly, that...
Because it doesn't say you get to double it.
No, you each get. That's
they were
right.
Taking that asterisk away, so you don't each get one.
You're in a situation of a crime victim reparation. The entire amount that each debtor has is exempt. In the situation of the personal bodily injury, each debtor has the right to exempt up to $10,000 of the award for that. So it's. What the statute currently, though, would mean that if only the husband was received a $10,000 or received a compensation for personal bodily injury, currently he could say, oh, well, I'm married, so I can exempt $20,000.
I understand that, where it's a one person's $10,000, and that you have the opportunity and say, we get to double it. It doesn't seem to work as well with those issues where you've got
personal injury awards had been made to each of, you know, husband and wife in that case, so they each have their own personal injury award, and maybe the substantive law is clear, but the form then seems to me to be unclear, doesn't it?
Well,
if we're taking away the asterisk, if I got this, I'd say, well, honey, I guess we have to pick yours or mine, because it's not going to be one of those asterisked ones that says that that you can each claim your...
See, and I guess I didn't read it that way, because I guess the way I read it was that each, while they might be both named in the case, the judgment to which you were getting the exemption is individual to each of them, and so they would each be entitled to claim whatever exemption would be entitled they would be entitled to under the terms. So if both had gotten an award, their exemption runs individually to both of them, and not separately.
Mr. Chair, that's why I asked if an exemption would actually be issued to two people, because in that that's clear. I think if husband gets an execution is directed to husband and a separate execution is directed to wife, that's why I was asking if you'd have an execution actually directed to both judgment debtors in one execution. Am I the one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shirley, I think in the context that you're speaking of, it would be more like a garnishment where maybe they have money in a bank account that was received for each of their personal bodily injuries, and basically if they each received an award, they each should be able to exempt up to $10,000 of their reward. So I agree with you that it may be misleading in the notice of the exempt property. And so I would suggest that maybe we should have some way of showing that if they each had a personal bodily injury award, that they could...
So it's more the issue of the form of the notice
form
of exempt property.
I think that's right. It's the way that note following the list reads back to the asterisk.
Right.
And that would suggest that, honey, we can't both claim one of these things. We're going to have to pick yours or mine.
Well, the garnishment statutes are full of forms, as this committee will have an opportunity to take a look at further down the road when you see some additional changes that are being proposed. Well, I think we'll do like on this one, like we did on the last one. I'm going to recommend that you work with counsel, and we know a lot of people who Gary and I do, having spent the last 4 years together on a garnishment and judgment work group.
4 years? It
seems like a lifetime.
Yeah,
we know a lot of people who know a lot about garnishment forms, and so why don't we try to work that out and satisfy, again, Representative Chetterly's concerns on this issue.
Chair, if I'm the one that's missing something here, I'm happy to be told that.
I would agree with you.
You do?
Yes.
Okay. Then I'm.
So you've convinced the person carrying the bill. So
yes.
That's in front of the committee. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2061.
Thank you.
All right. Let's see if Representative Chetterly can roadblock House Bill 2064. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2064. This one's got lots of stuff in it, Representative. And I'll ask, is it Kevin Chames? Is that right? Is that how I pronounce it? Also representing the Oregon State Bar. Please come forward.
Thank you.
Please begin. I'm sorry. Counsel was going to give us just a brief introduction and then go ahead.
Ever so brief. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 2064 also introduced the request of the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary for the Oregon State Bar Procedures and Practice Committee would create a declaration under penalty of perjury as an alternative to an affidavit under the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. The reason for this, as explained by the Oregon State Bar, is that it has been difficult to get notaries in rural areas, and the necessity to get affidavits notarized has created additional expense, and that a declaration would be an alternative that is used in other jurisdictions and would be less expensive and would not have all of the full evidentiary privileges that an affidavit would, but would suffice for many situations where an affidavit is simply an unnecessary expense and burden.
Welcome, Mr. Chambers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kevin Chambers. I've been a member of the bar since 1987. I currently sit on the Oregon State Bar Procedure and Practice Committee, which is a committee made up evenly of plaintiffs and defense counsel, which basically analyze bills and the laws that are already in front of you and comment on how those laws or bills will impact the civil justice system. What we're promulgating here in 2064 is basically what the committee, or Mr. Chairman, talked about earlier about trying to take a shortened step in the process. And what enacting 2064 would do would be to simply bring Oregon in compliance with most of the other jurisdictions, which allow declarations as opposed to affidavits. One of the reasons, of course, is sometimes it's hard to find somebody to get something notarized. At the same time, that's not always a problem, but it adds something else and something else that somebody has to do in order to further typical documents that would be sent to the court anyway. Actually, in the fourth paragraph of what I've given you, where it says these types of declarations are currently used in federal courts in Oregon, actually, these types of declarations are codified at 28 U.S.C. 1746 and are allowed to be used in all types of federal proceedings. There are a couple of types of situations where you cannot use a declaration. However, those are set out in the statute. This would simply allow lawyers and people representing themselves pro se to sign a declaration right in front of their name that specifically says, I am giving this testimony under the penalty of perjury, and I think actually that would have an even greater impact on the declarant than actually going and standing in front of a notary and simply, you know, having them identify through your driver's license that you're the person signing the form. Somebody I was talking to, one of the other members of the committee on the way down to testify today, and he actually said to me, when was the last time anybody remembers actually going in front of a notary and having them ask you to raise your hand and swear that everything in there was true? However, if we were to pass this, anybody that signs that is going to see right in front of their name, I swear under penalty of perjury that the statement that I'm signing right now is true. And so I think it would actually have a bigger impact on the declarant than simply going before a notary and saying, you know, that's my, or I am that person and this is my statement. It doesn't change any of the requirements with respect to real property or any of the other types of things where a notary is required, except those parts of the rules of civil procedure relative to what attorneys and clients commonly do now, which just requires another step, and that step being get a notary. I don't believe that this has any impact on any other type of financial or any other type of impact on any type of public policy. I'd be happy to answer any questions that any of you might have.
Are there questions about House Bill 2064, Mr. James? Yes, Representative McPherson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I may be revealing what a sheltered life I've lived working in a large law office. I had the impression that it was customary for essentially every law office to have one or more individuals who are notary public, a notary qualification in place. Is that an inaccurate understanding?
Mr. Chair, Representative, with all due respect, I think it probably is. One of the things that I talked to one of the other committee members on the way down is actually most lawyers in Oregon practice in either sole practice or small practices, so you're always kind of searching for where there is a notary. It's not uncommon for me to have clients come in and have to send them over to the bank because my secretary's not there, or just something's it's not uncommon, I think, in private and small practice to be searching for somebody to notarize documents.
I know several solo practitioners who, for that very reason, have also become notary publics, and more often than not, that works out okay, but there are instances where you don't want the lawyer also being the notary on an affidavit, for example, for a lot of varying reasons. Representative Sherrill?
I was just saying, you don't have to fill out your notary journal.
If I might add to that.
There's a lot to be said for that.
And if I might add to that, Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of times that I'm preparing a document for my own signature, and I've got to go find somebody to notarize it when I could simply send that document in. if I was able to just sign it with my own declaration.
Right. Certainly the use of declarations in federal court has been a common practice that has resulted in my knowledge of almost no instance of problem. So I don't know that this is a major issue. Representative Ackman, do you have a thought?
I just have one thing. Happy with the bill.
Yeah, okay, because I'm about ready to do something.
I know, that's what I hope we do. The only thing I had, I think, just for the record, this comes to us, of course, amending the rules of civil procedure. Normally that comes through the Council on Court Procedures, but asking Bob Olson in the back, and this actually comes at their request because it requires, I guess, a statutory amendment. So.
Yeah, I guess I was going to ask the same question about the position of the Council on Court Procedures on this bill. Do they... Are they here?
Mr. Chairman.
Your Honor, please, please come forward. So please take a seat here at the...
coincidentally only in the building today.
I am also coincidentally a member of the Council on Court Procedures, have been for about 8 years. This does come to you with their request and blessing, been reviewed very carefully by them, and the only comment, if I may, that I'd like to add in response to some of the questions are that this originally came, at least in part, in response to concerns by those who practice in a fashion that requires affidavits from people who live out of state, and often those are difficult to get because you go to find a notary public in California and they apparently don't know what you're talking about, or you have to go someplace special because it's not common a practice there as it is in Oregon. So, for example, those in Medford, where I think the request originated perhaps, who have clients or witnesses in Northern California, have a harder time complying with our requirements for affidavits than they would under this amendment. That's the reason for the amendment, and it comes to you with both the blessing and with the amendments already prepared from the Council on Court Procedures. So this is the statutory piece that needs to go along with it for the Council to do its job as well.
Good. Thank you very much. That's very helpful, Your Honor. We appreciate you coming forward. Are there any other questions about the bill? Well, then, hearing enough, it sounds like we may have a winner. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2064, and we'll open a work session. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Crummell.
I just have one question,
yeah.
And that is, does this mean that this will put teeth into the declaration that now are on the tops of the forms for people that testify before our committees?
Well, that's a whole other kettle of fish, Representative Crummell, that isn't affected here, but that's a discussion still ongoing, I think, in this building. I would entertain a motion from Representative Barker.
I move to move the bill forward.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2064 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, being from Southern Oregon, I wanted to get that motion, but I yield to my friend from Northern Oregon.
Take home. Yeah. Any objection? Hearing on House Bill 2064 will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Barker, I just think this bill has your name on it.
Mr. Chair, but it seems like Vice Chair Anderson really might need this back home, and this would probably, I want to reconsider.
Well, we could potentially assign him as a co-character, but I typically don't like to do that on a bill of this size. So we'll let Representative Barker handle this, and Council would be pleased to work with you in preparation for what I anticipate is likely your maiden voyage on the floor. All right. Okay. Last bill of the day. We'll open a hearing on House Bill 2066. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2066 was introduced at the request of the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary at the request or for the Judicial Department, which is essentially a housekeeping bill. It makes miscellaneous changes to the Oregon laws governing the courts. It would specifically eliminate provisions requiring that a trial must be scheduled for a violation if the conviction of the violation would result in a revocation or suspension of the driving privileges. It would eliminate the requirement that city charters and amendments have to be filed at the State of Oregon Law Library. It would require that a statement requesting costs and disbursements on appeal be certified, not verified. it would provide that the court may delegate powers of his or her office to employees of the judicial department. It permits tax court magistrates to waive court fees and costs, and it authorizes the Chief Justice to prescribe the form of the oath of the office of the judge and justices. And do we have any?
We do. Brad Swank from the courts, come forward.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department, and this is our bill that was introduced at our request. Each session, the Oregon Judicial Department brings to the legislature tweaks to the statutes about how courts do things to try and improve minor things and problems that have been brought to us by judges or court clerks or others. In the system. This one does six, and your committee counsel, Mr. Joseph, has summarized them. I'll make a few minor comments. Not much to add to what he said, except for on the provision for having the courts not schedule trials on failures to appear. This applies to non-traffic violations. In the last session, the scheduling of trials for failures to appear on traffic was eliminated, but at the same time there was another bill that was creating a suspension for failure to appear on a minor in possession, and those bills sort of crossed, and this would catch those up. The people actually do get notice. They get a notice. We send something to the DMV. DMV sends them a notice that says you've got 60 days to clear this up before the suspension takes effect, which causes them hopefully to come back into the court, and for the most part, these people don't show up when we schedule the trial anyway. So it's the question was, how many notices did you want to pay for? And it hasn't caused any problems by eliminating it for the traffic. On the second one, the not requiring city charters amendments to be filed with the Oregon State Law Library, it's something that's rarely done anyway. And there's no penalty for them not doing it. It has no effect on the charter, so we don't get them. They don't send them in. We've got a few old ones back there, and they come in sporadically, and we wondered why we're doing this. Section 3, amending, cleaning up language in ORS 2320. Certified is the word that's used by ORCP 17. Verified is not. It's an attempt to clean up the language and make it consistent. Section 4, which amends the ORS 8.120, the State Court Administrator's authority to delegate power. This change would allow delegation, would expand the authority to be broad enough. Currently, the State Court Administrator can delegate to people within her office. This would expand the authority broad enough so that she could delegate certain contracting authority to local trial court administrators, which would help us do some things more effectively. Section 5 amends 21605. Apparently there's one tax court judge. There are a number of magistrates, but the tax court judge is the only one who can waive fees for coming to the tax court. This would allow some magistrates to do that rather than all of those having to go to the judge every time. And Section 6 through 10 on the Chief Justice's authority to prescribe a single form of judicial oath of office. You probably have been tracking the issues that have been going to the courts and the number of challenges that have been coming to judges because some people don't think there's some confusion about which oath of office, which judges are supposed to be signing it. This would help us clear that up. It's a simple bill. It's got a subsequent or a referral to Ways and Means, and I can answer any questions you've got.
Are there any questions? Representative Crummell, then Representative Bark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. The first one being in Section 1, by repealing the provision requiring that a trial be scheduled for the revocation of a defendant's driving privileges, then what kind of due process will a defendant have if their driving privileges are going to be revoked?
Chair Williams, Representative Crummell, the due process is, and this only applies to instances where they've failed to appear because of the way the statute is written, and it only applies in instance of the change will only be effective for non-traffic, because if you look at the language that's being deleted, there's all that was a change that was made last session that said we don't have to schedule a trial. if they've failed to appear on a traffic matter, we can go ahead and send it to DMV. And the other one that's remaining is minor in possession, and what we do is they get the ticket, they fail to appear, we can default. We send a notice to DMV. DMV sends them a 60-day notice that says, you've got to go get this cleared up in 60 days at the local court, or a suspension will take effect. So they get a notice giving them 60 days. Statute also gives them up to a year to come in and get that default removed by making a motion to the judge and saying, look, I was out of town, I was on vacation, I was in Hawaii for 6 months, I didn't get the notice, it was my twin brother, my tire was flat, any number of whatever that they...
So any excuse will do, in other words?
Well, mostly if people bothered to come in and make a presentation to the judge, they've got some reason, and they've got a year to do it by statute and get the default removed and rescheduled if they want the trial.
Okay.
I can't promise you that there's never any problem with it, but there are a number of safeguards down the road for people.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow-up.
With regards to the oath of offices, and I know that this was a hot issue in the last election period with a couple of things that were on the ballot. But basically I guess I'm a little bit confused as well, because in Section 8, starting on line 31 and going through line 37, that has, and I recognize that has to do with the Supreme Court, but when by stating that the judge has to take the oath of office on the form prescribed in Section 7, Article 7 of the Oregon Constitution, and then stating that he has to, upon entering the duties of, must take and subscribe and transmit to the Secretary of State an oath in substantially the form prescribed by the Chief Justice. Mm-hmm. Isn't that kind of redundant?
Well, actually, Chair Williams, Representative Kummel, I didn't write the legislation. We presented the concept to Legislative Counsel's office, and this is the way it came back to solve that issue, and for entering into pro tempore. And subsection 3 of 1.600 applies to the duties of a judge pro tempore of the Supreme Court must take and subscribe. Mm-hmm. Subscribe to the Constitution. And that's the way it came back.
Okay. And then I guess the follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair, to that is then going back to the Section 6. And am I wrong in assuming or wrong in that the Constitution, Oregon Constitution, states what an oath shall be? As far as a judge taking an oath?
Chair Williams, Representative Crummell, the Oregon Constitution states what the oath is for Supreme Court justices.
But not for Circuit Court or Tax Court or any other appellate courts and so on.
Right, and there has been an argument about which oaths apply, and there's some statutory provisions in this. The request was to clean that up. It doesn't change the constitutional provision for Supreme Court justices, but the concept is to clean up for the rest of the judges for whom the Constitution does not establish the oath.
So the Chief Justice does have the authority then by the Constitution to prescribe what the oath would be for the lower courts. Is that an assumption, or is that...
Representative Williams, Chair Williams, Representative Crummell, not currently. I mean, currently there is some confusion about the oath authority and which oaths people take, other than Supreme Court justices, and the Constitution does not clearly give the Chief Justice that authority. Now, some people argue that the Chief Justice has that authority. The idea behind this concept was to make it clear that the Chief Justice could create a single oath that would apply to all of those judges in the judicial branch whose oath isn't prescribed by the Constitution.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Along that same line, it would seem to me that if the Supreme Court justices are sworn in by a constitutional oath, it would be simple to just do the same thing with all of the other judges in the state to make it the oath of the Constitution.
Representative Williams, Chair Williams, Representative Anderson, the Chief Justice may in fact do that. I have no idea what the Chief is going to do. I think his desire is to move towards a single oath that everybody can take, that's clear and simple, and that may be the one that he picks.
Yes, Representative.
I'm sorry. It would seem to me that I'd like to hear from him that's kind of what he's thinking of doing, that not just left to his discretion, but rather follow the same standard for each court. And I personally would like to hear from him or your department that that's where he's heading.
Representative Shetterly, then Representative Barker.
Well, thank you. Just in answer to that, Representative Anderson, I had a question about that. The constitutional oath, and it is specific to, by its language, to a judge of the Supreme Court, so wouldn't work in general application across the trial courts, although the structure of it otherwise would, except for the language that's specific to being sworn in as a judge of the Supreme Court of the state. The other question I had is, Meg, if I can, in Section 1, Brad, I hear what you're saying, but tell me how what would be left of the statute makes it applicable only to FTAs, to failures to appear. That statute would simply say the court may require that a trial be held in any violation proceeding. And I'm looking at your notes, and I think your testimony also refers to failure. I guess the question I have is saying that the court may require that a trial be held. I guess the discomfort with the language, does that suggest that the court may not require that a trial not be held? I don't know.
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, a few years ago, one of the procedures that was passed by this body was a procedure that allows the court in violation level offenses to default a case. And they don't always want to default because there are sometimes when somebody's been enough of a problem that they want to call them in and do them, because there are certain limitations if you default. For instance, you can if they fail to appear. But yes, there are instances when they wouldn't want to have a trial, when they'd want to just go ahead and default. And if it was an instance, they can do it for many offenses that for which license suspension is not an issue. And this would just make this particular, primarily minor in possession, something where it would work the same way as most other offenses, and that is you get a default, the notice goes to DMV, DMV gives you the 60-day notice, and you've got 60 days to come in and pay your fine or ask the court to reschedule or something like that. Make a defense, ask for the fine to be reduced, those sorts of things. So, yes, there would be instances where the court would not initially schedule a trial, because scheduling a trial takes time and involves clerks and review and those sorts of things. They just default and send it on to DMV. Like I said, this was something that was done for traffic offenses in the last session, because in most instances, if you schedule the trial, the people don't show up.
Further questions, Representative Barker?
My colleagues have pretty much covered this, but on the oath, the people who are complaining about that, at least the ones I've seen who are forbidden on police property in the city of Portland, which may say something to their credibility, and they also are telling people you don't need the Constitution allows you to drive without a license or license plates. But their big hang-up was that in the judge's oath it said it will deal with impartiality. So, I mean, it would seem that I don't know why we don't just go ahead and use that same oath, change the language so it doesn't say Supreme Court. Just, I think then there wouldn't be any question at all, because their big contention is judges don't have to be impartial. They're biased against me, and here it is right in the oath, and they refuse to take it. Therefore, he's not really a judge or she's not really a judge. Just as a housekeeping thing, I mean, it just would seem to me just to go ahead and stick that language in.
Chair Williams, Representative Barker, it's actually easier to amend the statute or to change something by rule or by Chief Justice order than it is to amend the Constitution.
And there may be some discussion about which language is appropriate and whether it should have, because there have been two oaths out there that have been floating around, one sent out by the Secretary of State and one sent out by that was prescribed for Supreme Court justices. And there may be considerations. We thought the easiest way to do this would be to allow the Chief Justice to set up and to do the appropriate language and decide what that was, and then it would be clear. And it'd stop all of the paperwork that flows from every judge getting challenged by certain people every time they sit on a case.
Representative Sheriff.
Thank you. Again, just on Section 1 and 6, if I can, Brad. Section 1, I'm just trying to build some comfort for people who see the changes here. Where in the current law, it says, you know, unless a plea of guilty or no contest is entered, a trial must be scheduled. And we're taking that language out. And so there appears, anyway, if you look at this, that we're making it discretionary in the court in any event whether a trial be scheduled. And obviously that's not the case. But to address that, wouldn't it be just as easy to leave in the current language, but when you are down on line 14, just delete the language that says on a citation for a traffic offense, from the, basically to the end of the sentence, so that we say that the court must schedule a violation unless it's on a plea of guilty or no contest, but notwithstanding that, the court's not required to schedule a trial if the defendant fails to appear. Period. And that way, then, we're leaving in law, we're leaving in place the current.
And if I could add, as evidence to that, I received an email from Mr. Barlow, who is a frequent participant often in front of this committee, and I wouldn't doubt is probably listening to us over the Internet, probably from home right now, who apparently lives in Bend. He raised this very issue that you're pointing to, this discomfort level with what appears to at least be sort of this removal of a right to a trial in this suspension situation. And he also raised concerns about Section 6, which has been fairly well enumerated. So,
Chair Williams, Representative Chatterley, I actually had a discussion with the Legislative Council's office along those same lines when this was being drafted, and it was Legislative Council's decision to saying that if you took out for a traffic offense, there was no need for any of the language from lines 10 through 15, and that was, you go, okay.
Well, we can have a conversation with them about
for
that.
For perception, I think.
I think that probably makes some sense.
And, Mr. Chair, as long as he's looking at that, the only other thing I was going to ask, again, for comfort and perception as much as anything, Brad, in Section 6, would it be possible for us to say that the, this is maybe a constitutional question, separation of powers, could we say that the Chief Justice shall prescribe a form of oath substantially in the following form and then provide the language of the oath in statute? And when we say substantially, we're giving the court then, I'm not sure we can absolutely mandate, but then we've at least got in statute what the prescribed form of oath should be, and then everyone knows what the elements should be in that.
Chair Williams, Representative Shirley, I don't know the exact reason. I can go back and check and see why it was drafted this particular way. There may have been a concern about separation of powers issues. I don't know on that, but I can check to see if in terms of the oath thing there's that issue.
Because I know this is an issue of simmering public concern, and the better job we can do at just saying what it's going to be, I think will help quell the concerns that are out there.
Yeah, I agree. So, Brad, if you could have that discussion with the chief and other folks over at the court and circle back to Mr. Joseph, and if there's a sense that this needs to be talked about further, I'd be pleased to make myself available to the chief or anyone else over at the court on this discussion. And similarly, Bill, sort of following on the discussion we had about Section 1, if you could perhaps talk to Legislative Council about preparing an amendment that would effectuate change that was discussed. discussed, essentially reinstating most of that language so it doesn't make it look like we're taking away a person's right to a trial on a license suspension. I'd like to see what they think about that. Any other discussion? Yes, Representative Prozanski.
Mr. Chair, I think what Representative Shudley's brought up is probably a more comfortable fix. I'm just wondering, besides stopping like it, if the defendant fails to appear, go ahead and enumerate again on a citation for a violation.
Sure.
It may be redundant, but it may be something that gives some clarity.
Representative Prozanski, you just got yourself appointed to work with Mr. Joseph on looking at that amendment before it comes back to the committee.
I knew it was going to happen, but I waited for at least when I had
one
some
one that you had with. Some experience with. Sure, that's a good way to do this.
Got a couple of violation ones I'll show you later.
Okay, good, good. All right, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2066. Thanks, everyone, and we'll adjourn the committee.
Sure. I was supposed to make an announcement.
Please. Yep.